I think it's the most tactically skilled violent non-state actor operating in the world. You know, many of their operatives right now are probably running scared. That's exactly the type of psychological fear the Israelis are hoping to have here. That's just kind of like icing on the cake for Mossad to sit back and watch these guys now try to figure out, you know, who may be the mole.
Hey, welcome back to the Modern War Institute podcast, brought to you with the generous support of the West Point class of 1974. I'm John Amble, and on this episode, I'm joined by Colin Clark, director of research at the Soufan Group and a senior research fellow at the Soufan Center. He is a scholar who specializes in non-state terrorist and insurgent groups, groups like Hezbollah. So when several thousand pagers belonging to Hezbollah members suddenly exploded in what is assumed to be an Israeli intelligence operation recently, I was eager to hear his insights. There are big and important questions surrounding this operation to explore, not just what happened and how, but also why, and why now? Is this just a particularly striking incident in an ongoing shadow war between Israel and Hezbollah? Or is it potentially a shaping operation ahead of an escalation? How should we contextualize the pager attack and the heightened cross-border strikes from both sides that have followed it, alongside Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza? And how is Hezbollah likely to respond to such a glaring failure in its operational security? We explore those questions and more in this episode. Before we get to it, though, a couple quick things. First, a very special thank you to the West Point class of 1974 for their generous support to MWI. And second, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with Colin Clark. Colin, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the Modern War Institute podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So the central premise of this episode is a bit strange for me. We are the Modern War Institute, and when we talk about modern war, we tend to talk about modern things, technology, modern communications technology. And I asked you to come on today to talk about pagers, which is sort of decidedly unmodern or feels decidedly unmodern. I think it's, you know, it's all but impossible that listeners won't have an idea what we're talking about when I mention pagers, because it's been all over the news this week. But earlier this week, several days ago, at effectively the same time or within a very narrow time frame, thousands of pagers blew up, mostly in the pockets of Hezbollah members. And I kind of want to kick off by asking you what your initial reactions were when, you know, your first thoughts are this has to be a coordinated operation, acknowledging that we don't know exactly what happened. I think Occam's razor makes it a pretty reasonably safe assumption to assume that this was a coordinated Israeli action. So yeah, if I could just ask you kind of what your initial reactions were when you saw the news break.
Yeah, so it was interesting. I was in a classified conference and didn't have laptop or phone and came outside and checked my phone. And it also happened to be my birthday that day. And I looked down and saw, you know, a flurry of messages, text messages, missed calls. And I thought, wow, I'm so loved. I have all these people reaching out to me, only to find out it was journalists asking me about pagers. And so, you know, luckily I've listened to a lot of 90s hip hop. And so that's kind of kept me well steeped in pagers and beepers. But yeah, I mean, I was, I guess, in some ways surprised, probably at the magnitude and the coordination, not at the intent or at the target whatsoever. I think it's obviously reasonable to suggest that this was the Mossad. And, you know, I think after October 7th, the Israeli intelligence services, including Mossad, really got beat up a lot. And I think if you look at this pager attack, if you look at the assassination of Hamas political bureau leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran in late July, the way that these were done in a very kind of Hollywood-esque manner, to me, looks like Mossad trying to get its swagger back and to say, you know, October 7th was the anomaly, not going forward, and really trying to kind of refurbish its image and show that it is the preeminent intelligence service in the region.
Refurbish its image with who? With Hezbollah, with Israelis, multiple?
With everybody. Because in some ways, you know, whether it's, you know, Steven Spielberg making movies or, you know, the Netflix shows or Apple, there's been a number of kind of, you know, Hollywood productions that make the Mossad seem omnipotent. And I think that was largely what the brand represented, you know. And even when Mossad's not responsible for things, there's this conspiracy that their hands behind everything, right? Which shows that what they're doing works. They're kind of living rent free in a lot of heads of militant leaders across the region and heads of state, autocrats, et cetera. I think for everybody, for themselves, you know, for morale and a spirit of corps, for Israelis to show that, you know, they are the preeminent intelligence service, and for their adversaries throughout the region to say, you know, you got one over on us once, but we're not going to slip up again.
You know, I reached out to you after I read an article that you wrote that was published by Foreign Policy. There are a lot of interesting questions to kind of explore surrounding this activity. There's the what actually happened. There's the how, of course, which is a fascinating question. But there are also the two kind of linked questions of why and why now. You kind of talked a little bit about why, and we'll dig into that a little bit deeper. But I find why now a really interesting question, because that was the first thing that popped in my mind was, is this the time when the benefit is maximized for launching this operation, using this capability that Israel clearly had? What are your thoughts on that? Why now?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of hypotheses. One is that this could be potentially part of shaping operations for some kind of broader, you know, people have been talking about a ground invasion. I don't see the Israelis going in with a ground force similar to the way that they've gone into Gaza. I think if they do go in, it will be a very quick lightning strike. You know, obviously, if you think about the Israelis occupying southern Lebanon from 1982 to 2000, it conjures up some really painful memories and images on all sides. And I think the way that that would inflame the Arab and Islamic world would probably discount that as an option. You know, any kind of long-term occupation type where they look to dismantle Hezbollah's infrastructure. That said, you know, it was the pager attack followed by the walkie-talkie attack, followed by airstrikes. We're now hearing reports of targets against high-profile Hezbollah members, including Ibrahim Akil, who the United States has part of its Reward for Justice program, other high-ranking members. And this comes on top of, obviously, the Fuad Shaker assassination a couple of months ago. So, you know, are the Israelis priming the pump for something more aggressive? You know, the fact that we're even discussing this means that no one's sure, right? They're leaving a lot of people guessing, which I think, you know, works to their advantage. Or is this just another tit for tat as part of the ongoing shadow war between Israel, the Iranians, and Iran's proxies?
Yeah, you know, I think it would make life a lot easier for analysts, for observers, if we could treat Hamas as this individual thing distinct from other groups, other actors, other dynamics at play in the region. But that's simply not the case, right? And Hezbollah is one of these groups. I would also think that from the perspective of a planner, of a strategist in Israel, I would want to deal with one of these problems before turning to the other one. And yet, you know, I think there are indications that Israel doesn't necessarily see them as distinct or as separate problems. So do you think that this is that sort of ongoing tit for tat? Look, we've seen tensions spike since last October along that border. 60,000 Israelis have been displaced by Hezbollah rockets being launched into Israel. Do you think that this is, I guess, deliberately aimed at escalating tensions with Hezbollah and potentially triggering an escalation, because it's pretty predictable?
Yeah, I mean, look, I've been somewhat skeptical of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's motives. A lot of people have as well. I've been very open about this, speaking about it on TV and writing about it. I think his views often diverge from senior IDF officials, from large swaths of the Israeli public. I think there's a lot of political dynamics that are working behind the scenes, not just in Israel, including in the United States. You know, there's this perception that we're in a strange place right now with a president that's already, you know, confirmed that he's going to be stepping down, and we're kind of moving into this area. I don't want to call him a lame duck, but this is a window of opportunity, not only for U.S. adversaries, but also for allies that maybe see things differently than we do, namely the Israelis, to kind of push the envelope here without getting significant, you know, grumbling from the United States. So there's so many elements at play. Given, you know, how things have gone in Gaza, it is a bit puzzling to me that the Israelis would seek to open up a second front. But now they've formally said that, you know, returning Israeli citizens to the north are part of their overall war aims, right? So now it's on the docket. This is something that they've pledged to do. And the only way that they're going to do that, at least kinetically, is to push Hezbollah back. The United States allies are working overtime diplomatically. Amos Hochstein spends a lot of time in the region trying to get some kind of a diplomatic deal done. But short of that, you know, we're moving, inching closer towards all-out conflict between Israel and Hezbollah, which, as you know, it's a quite different animal than Hamas. This is a far more sophisticated entity on multiple levels. It functions more like a conventional military than it does a terrorist group. And it's also got tentacles that stretch throughout the globe from Latin America to West Africa and beyond, and could do some serious damage to Israeli or American interests overseas.
Can we kind of, I guess, explore that a little bit more? Because I think a lot of listeners will have an intuitive sense that, look, no non-state actor, no Islamist militant group is the same as any other. And yet I think some of those distinctions are really important to understand. You know, your perspective as somebody who has studied these sorts of groups, these sorts of actors for many, many years, I think is insightful here. Can you describe a little bit more detail how Hezbollah differs as an organization and as a threat actor than, say, Hamas?
Just capabilities to start with. This is a group that now boasts an arsenal of 150,000 rockets and precision-guided munitions. Extremely high skill level. I think it's the most tactically skilled violent non-state actor operating in the world. It's been around since the early 1980s. It's benefited significantly from Iranian largesse and patronage and training from the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Quds Force, right? Working hand in glove with elite units throughout the region. Look at the battlefield experience that Hezbollah fighters have gotten in Syria, fighting there. They've done it also alongside the Wagner Group, Russian mercenaries. So you look at kind of different types of interoperability and things that they've learned. And they're also able to use, you know, places like Syria as a battlefield laboratory to test out weapons and test out, you know, different approaches, different tactics, techniques, and procedures. So, you know, this is not a group to be trifled with. The Israelis know that. I think they're well aware of what they'd be getting into. At the same time, you know, Hezbollah really doesn't want this conflict. I think they have to respond to this latest provocation, even if it's performative or symbolic. They have to do something because, as you know, in the Middle East, there's nothing worse than appearing weak, and they will appear weak if they let, you know, these recent Mossad or Israeli attacks go unanswered.
Yeah, you lose your wasta pretty quickly if you give off that perception of weakness. Why doesn't Hezbollah want this conflict? Now, if presumably we assume that Hezbollah does at some point want conflict with Israel, why not now?
I think, you know, they've been reminded of how serious of an actor Israel is, right? And you kind of see with these recent strikes, you see the capability, the reach all the way into Tehran. This is the most superior military in the region. And I think they're playing for keeps. So I think, you know, this isn't kind of another one of those, you know, border skirmishes. That they're ready, and they've made it clear that they're ready for all out war. And I'm not sure Hezbollah is prepared for that.
What about the challenge of, you know, it's hard for me to even fully conceptualize what Israel, and again, you know, we shouldn't necessarily treat Israel as a monolith in terms of their strategic thinking or the strategic thinking of Israelis or Israeli leaders. However, for the sake of simplicity in this conversation, you know, Israel has been warned. There are lots of observers that have warned of the difficulty of dislodging Hamas from Gaza, an organization with 40,000 people that has been the de facto governing authority for a decade and a half or more. In Lebanon, Hezbollah is even further integrated into the country, into society. There are Hezbollah government. Members of parliament. Right. Yeah. You know, what is your perspective about Israel's potential strategic objectives in the event of a conflict with Hezbollah?
I don't know that they have strategic objectives when it comes to Hezbollah, because they haven't demonstrated any when it comes to Hamas. I've written about this. I had a piece in Foreign Affairs back in February warning against what I called the counterinsurgency trap, right? General Petraeus came out and said the Israelis should do counterinsurgency in Gaza. And, you know, with all due respect to General Petraeus, who's done, you know, a lot for our country and for thinking along these lines, he was referring specifically to population-centric counterinsurgency, which I just don't think the Israelis are postured to do. They don't seem like they're trying to win hearts and minds in Gaza. And so that's been one of my main critiques of their approach, is it's tactics divorced from strategy. What's the end game here in Gaza? It's not going to be to occupy it indefinitely. And who are they working with, you know, to reestablish some sense of governance there? So I've been disappointed in the lack of strategy. And so that also makes you wonder, what's the end game for Hezbollah? You can go in like a bull in a china shop, break a whole bunch of stuff, but they did that in 2006. And here we are in 2024 with a much stronger, much more capable Hezbollah, right? This is an entity that has its own construction company, Jihad al-Bina. They just go in, they repair everything, you know, that further cements their own legitimacy, even though it's a bit of, you know, the arsonist and the firefighter in some respects. And then life goes on, and they're so inextricably linked to the Lebanese state, you know, which, as you know, is very fragile and weak. There's no uprooting them. It's the same thing when we used to have these discussions about Afghanistan of like, you're not going to kill and capture the Taliban. They're ethnic Pashtuns. They live there. They're not going anywhere. They're not the same as Al-Qaeda. Those are different entities. And I think we struggled to recognize that for a long time.
Yeah. If we kind of zoom back into this specific action that we saw this week with the pagers and walkie-talkies, you know, I guess from a Hezbollah perspective, if you put your Islamist militant group analyst hat on and you look at it from that perspective, how does Hezbollah respond when suddenly within the matter of minutes, it seems like thousands of their members have, you know, chunks of flesh taken out of their legs?
Yeah, it's been interesting because when you listen to Nasrallah speak, and I've probably listened to more of his speeches in the past year than I have in a very long time. He's always kind of very cool, calm, collected. He downplays, you know, whatever major incident just happened. This time he came out and admitted that this was a serious breach of Hezbollah's internal security. I think the Wall Street Journal was reporting today that Hezbollah is undertaking an internal mole hunt, which I wrote about a couple of days ago in Foreign Policy, that I expected as much, right? That's just kind of like icing on the cake for Mossad to sit back and watch these guys now try to figure out, you know, who may be the mole and start whacking people, suspected spies and infiltrators. So, you know, there's so many things going on. I also don't think it's difficult to analyze fully because it's still in motion. I mean, as we're having this conversation now, the Israelis are going after high profile targets in Hezbollah. And so it's difficult to say, you know, where this ends. I think this could be more a prelude to something broader than any kind of discrete tactical strikes.
Yeah, you know, the mole hunt seems like a very logical response because, you know, your first thought is you look at this and you see there was probably some influence over the supply chain, right? Whether or not that was explosives packed into these devices or something other than that. But in order to be able to pull this off, you also need to have some means of influencing, once these devices are in the country, that they actually go to the people you want to. Because the last thing that Israel needs is all of these pagers going to doctors and all over Lebanon or even out of the country. And then, I mean, there was control over where these devices...
Someone had them on a plane, right? You know, exactly. A civilian or something. There's a lot of, you know, ways this could have gone sideways.
And so if you're looking at it from Hezbollah's perspective, it looks like a really serious... intrusion into its, you know, its practices, its structures. How do you think that will go? Does Hezbollah have the means of improving their internal security and rectifying what was clearly a major, major error?
You know, in many ways, yes, because they've done it for so long. This is a group that prizes operational security and expertise in tradecraft. But, you know, you've heard the expression, the devil you know versus the devil you don't. One of the, I guess, benefits for counterterrorism forces in a long war is that they become intimately familiar with their enemy. They see multiple opportunities to turn members, to flip them, right? There's different vulnerabilities. And this happened over time with the IRA in Northern Ireland. You know, this was a group that was highly disciplined, was well regarded for its own kind of operational security. And toward the end, you know, the Brits had flipped some of their highest ranking members, you know, and including someone that was in charge of assassinating spies. So they had flipped someone that was in charge of looking for other spies. He was the head of what they called their nutting squad. So, you know, over time, a really elite intelligence service, which Mossad certainly is, can find these vulnerabilities. But this was meticulously planned. This was a pretty exquisite operation. I know there's been claims of different types of civilian casualties and collateral damage, but from what I can tell, it was fairly contained given the expanse of the overall operation.
I want to ask you a question, I guess, about the groups like this, their choices about adopting technology, because choosing to use pagers and walkie-talkies, pretty low-tech communications devices, is a deliberate choice, right? Because it protects them against the vulnerability, or what they perceive to be the vulnerability, of using cell phones and other things that can be hacked, that can be targeted with cyber means. If, as a group, you decide to use a low-tech means of communication like this, and then this happens, how do you respond? Do you go more low-tech? Do you just say, hey, there's nothing we can do, so we're just going to accept that there's some risk of this in a world that is increasingly defined by the internet and connectivity?
I think they're closing ranks as we speak. I think, you know, the top leaders, whoever's still alive, is absolutely ditching all electronics. You know, it's something Nasrallah had actually implored months ago in a speech. But at the same time, you have to run command and control of your organization. And so they're going to be significantly challenged in that regard. And I think they're going to have to do a real comprehensive assessment of what has to change going forward, because I think many folks, many of their operatives right now are probably running scared, right? You have no idea what's coming around the corner. That's exactly the type of psychological fear the Israelis are hoping to have here. And the ultimate fear is that, or the ultimate aim is that it jams them up and gives them enough pause where maybe the Israelis see an opening to do whatever it is that they want to do next. They've been targeting, I think, some of the rocket launcher sites, obviously high value targets, individuals. We'll see what that leads to next.
And I guess that calculus, that decision making about how to sort of close off your organization and its members from certain vulnerabilities, how does that compare to what you've witnessed when you've studied other groups? I know you watched ISIS very closely during its heyday, and it obviously took pretty serious steps to protect itself and maintain operational security.
You know, Hezbollah, it's an interesting comparison, because these are both groups, highly skilled. They spend a lot of time and resources and bandwidth on internal security, but so much of ISIS were people coming from outside. They were foreign fighters that were coming from elsewhere. And that made the job eminently more difficult, right? You've probably seen the intake forms that they have, but they don't really know, you know, who's who, coming from Europe, coming from North America, coming from all over the world. You know, Hezbollah is very much, you know, a Lebanese organization, even though it benefits from Iranian sponsorship and largesse. And so, you know, there's, I think, probably a greater sense of paranoia right now, because the thought is that they're much more difficult to penetrate. And I think that's largely true, right? I mean, this was a major intelligence, counterintelligence coup for the Israelis, but things like this don't happen very frequently. And I think, you know, Hezbollah's leaders are going to do their best to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again.
Do you think it's significant? I saw a tweet that you put out talking about the combination of intelligence and effectively special operations, because as you noted, that conventional militaries often struggle to deal with guerrilla organizations, insurgent organizations. You characterize this as potentially shaping operations for what's to come. With respect to Hezbollah specifically, do you think this is really an intelligence and special operations conflict more than a conventional forces conflict?
It's really interesting. The short answer is I don't know, and I'm still kind of like mulling this over in my head. I think, you know, conventionally it makes no sense for Hezbollah to line up and fight the Israelis conventionally. They're going to lose, right? But the Israelis, if they attempt to come in with conventional means against, you know, an insurgent group, I think Hezbollah then, you know, can benefit from that asymmetry. What the Israelis have done is attempt to reduce that asymmetry and make this more kind of network versus network. And I think that's what's caught Hezbollah off guard. You know, keep in mind the Israelis also call in air power, right? They have a kind of combination there that they're working with. But I think the force posture or the kind of tools that they've decided to use differs quite a bit from what they've done in Gaza. And I think it's certainly given them the initiative to kind of knock Hezbollah off balance and gives them an opening for some kind of more devastating strike, whether or not that comes.
I know Iran is not necessarily, you're not solely an Iran specialist, but if you look at this from the perspective of Tehran, what does it look like?
I think, you know, the Iranians have to be concerned because at the end of the day, Hezbollah is their kind of last line of defense, right? And I think if Hezbollah is decimated here and is dealt a serious blow, that makes the Iranians ever more vulnerable. And I think, you know, there's still that possibility for a broader regional conflict. The United States is, you know, has been flexing military muscle, sending carrier strike groups to the region, you know, all these attempts to quote unquote restore deterrence or refashion the red lines that existed before October 7th. I think so much is in flux right now. And at the end of the day, the regime in Tehran is all about survival. For them, that's the ultimate goal here. And I think there's probably, if they're being honest, some soul searching there and saying maybe we bit off more than we can chew here. But at the same time, the Iranians have been kind of masters of making the best of a bad situation, and kind of reaping the benefits using their proxy network, the Houthis in Yemen, Hashd al-Shaabi, Shia militias in Iraq and Syria, various groups in Gaza and the West Bank. So, I think we're also interested. We're entering just this really interesting period in the United States in the lead up to the election, where while foreign policy doesn't often, swing votes considerably, it's becoming a more and more salient topic as we get into, you know, these next several weeks leading up to November.
Does this have any impact on Israel's military campaign in Gaza? Because, you know, the more you think about it, the more these look like two completely different types of operations. One, air power and special operations and intelligence led. The other one, very conventional, a grinding campaign to seize territory effectively.
Yeah, so you could treat them different, you know, separately, but Israel's also such a small country, right? They're pulling manpower from a finite pool of people, including reservists. And so the longer this goes on, the more strain it puts on Israeli society. You still have the issue of the hostages, which is incredibly divisive. Netanyahu's wildly unpopular. And so, even if all fighting were to stop today, the Israelis have a lot to deal with internally. I think, you know, it's fair to say that their international opinion has been significantly damaged given the just high numbers of civilian casualties. And if you look in the West, you know, we just at the Sufan Center just completed a report on the impact of October 7th on the terrorist threat landscape in five Western countries. We looked at the US, UK, Italy, France, and Germany. And so this isn't a conflict that, you know, stays in the region. This has had major spillover impact to other countries, to the information environment. And I think, you know, it's not hyperbolic to say that this conflict, this kind of whatever you want to call it, I've said it's a low boil regional war since October 7th, has really kind of impacted the region in a major way. I mean, just think back to the United States continuously saying it's going to pivot to Asia. And here we are dealing with the Middle East, even after 20 plus years of the global war on terrorism. We can't pivot out of that region. We're stuck there and we're trying to make heads from tails.
You know, if we look at these groups, Hezbollah and Hamas are aligned in certain objectives. They both have relationships, although very different relationships, with Tehran, with Iran. Hezbollah began launching more rockets into northern Israel, I guess in support of Hamas in Gaza. But there are gaps. Can those gaps be exploited? You know, is there any possibility for Israel to encourage, if not force, encourage Hezbollah to sort of diminish its operations in support of Hamas?
So that's where the diplomacy comes in, and then the track two, the back channeling that's going on. The Israelis are obviously attempting to engage in coercive diplomacy with some of the kinetic actions, but I think that's the trick, is trying to convince the Iranians to separate these and treat these as isolated incidents. And I think, you know, it's smart on Iran's part to try to lump everything together. You know, when it doesn't behoove them, they separate these things, right? Think back to the JCPOA, Iran nuclear negotiations. They said, oh, no, the proxies are a different thing. We're just talking about this. But now when it benefits them, they say, oh, no, these are actually all part of the same conflict. And so they're always kind of playing these rhetorical games, tying us up in knots, and that kind of slows us down. You know, I think a different military might be able to engage in kind of more aggressive information operations in the region to exploit some of those gaps. But that's been a challenge for the Israelis. They're excellent on cyber and EW, electronic warfare, and other things. IO, they've been very kind of weak in terms of you know, using that as an effective lever in combat.
It strikes me that, you know, in the sort of the modern media landscape, you can go online and you could find very different narratives, right? To support your, I mean, we've seen this domestically with politics in the United States, but you can also kind of see it taking shape around this war. You have people who would say, actually, the Israelis are doing a great job of information operations because they're communicating exactly why this is a defensive war, why this is a just war, why this is a righteous war. But they're communicating that to people who are sort of predisposed toward accepting that narrative. They're not communicating it to exactly. They're not communicating it to, you know, people who they want to bring into the choir, but who are not part of the choir. Do you think, I guess, from an IO perspective, from an information perspective, I think you have to look at this operation with the pagers and consider it a successful intelligence operation, a wildly successful intelligence operation. However, is it more successful operationally or psychologically?
Yeah, I mean, maybe both, because you're taking Hezbollah fighters and you're putting them on the sidelines, all the people that were maimed and lost fingers and hands and, you know, whatever else. So from, you know, a tactical perspective or operational perspective, that counts. Psychologically, it's huge. Because you're not only impacting Hezbollah, but if you're the Houthis, if you're Kataib Hezbollah, if you're Palestinian Islamic Jihad, you know, you're now second guessing any kind of comms that you have that you're relying on, thinking that you could be next. So I think from that perspective, it's been, you know, I agree, an overwhelming success. I think where they've fallen short is on, you know, what we and sometimes these terms fall out of vogue, but what we used to call strategic communications, right? Synchronizing the say, your actions with your words. And so to say, you know, oh, you know, we're taking care of humanitarian concerns in Gaza, but just the rampant, you know, destruction and civilian casualties would allow people to make the opposite argument and to make that quite forcefully. And look, if you just look at kind of, I think, some of the demonstrations and protests around the world, you'd argue that Israel is actually not doing a very good job telling its story. With how many people, you know, are now marching in opposition to Israel's conduct in Gaza.
This operation was obviously, you know, page A1 above the fold news all week, mm-hmm. but a lot of things take that position of primacy in the news media. And within weeks, certainly, you know, years down the road, it's completely forgotten about. There are other things that stay with us and they sort of remain as inflection points in, you know, where a regional security balance tipped in a different direction or something new started. Do you think this is likely to be one of those things, or do you think we'll sort of return to the status quo ante, you know, in the days and weeks to come?
It all depends on what happens after this, right? If this was an actual prelude to some kind of broader sweeping operation, and that operation becomes a success, this will have been a hallmark. And we will think about this. If this is just a kind of another tit for tat in the kind of shadow war, then I would argue no, you know, that we're likely to kind of think about this all lumped together, the Haniyeh assassination, the Fuad Shukr hit, all these other things as kind of part of one broader campaign. So I think it depends. Well, you'll have to ask me that question and the next time I come on in a couple of months and we do an assessment of where things stand.
And If we do that, what are you going to be watching for in the next few months?
Yeah, I'm going to be watching for, strain on the IDF is if we move towards something more akin to a two-front war, how is that impacting the morale, the readiness of the Israeli Defense Forces? As an American, I'm perhaps selfishly concerned with how my country is impacted and what the U.S. military's role is in all of this. Looking at how the election impacts U.S. foreign policy, because I think if former President Trump is elected, you're probably looking at a much different approach to the conflict than if Vice President Harris is elected. At least that's the perception, I think, on the part of Netanyahu, is that Trump will give him more of a blank check to do what he needs to do. In conversations I've had with folks, they've pushed back and said, how could Netanyahu have any more of a blank check than he already does? But I would say, even if the U.S. isn't doing much to try to constrain Israel with pulling back, money for weapon sales or things like that, at least you hear the Biden administration kind of speaking vocally and openly about, warning against certain operations or kind of certain eventualities, where the perception is that Trump wouldn't do that. But again, I mean, that's Netanyahu's perception. I haven't been able to figure out, Trump's mercurial, to say the least. He could come in and act totally different. We just don't know.
Well, Colin, I want to thank you very much for joining me. It was a fascinating episode, and a fascinating subject to kind of discuss. So I want to thank you for coming on and sharing your perspective.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing, if you aren't following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.